You're listening to Atlanta Baseball Talk, your weekly podcast for all things Atlanta Braves.
Welcome to Atlanta Baseball Talk, show number 423. Today is Sunday, October 21st, 2018, and my name is Steve. No Hammy or Kurt tonight. Now, before we start, please help out the podcast by subscribing, writing a review, sharing links on Twitter and Facebook. If you don't, the Dodgers will not only win the World Series, Manny Machado will get series MVP. All right, folks, in tonight's show, we will wrap up the season and look toward off-season moves with David O'Brien of The Athletic. But first, a quick break. We're very happy to be joined by David O'Brien, senior writer for The Athletic Atlanta. And David, before we get to the Braves, congratulations on your new gig at The Athletic.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Yeah, so
it's going great.
Yeah, I'm interested. How has your day-to-day or, I don't know, your interaction with the team changed with the move to The Athletic?
Well, interaction obviously didn't change. Same job, you know, but I say it's the same job in that I'm covering the Braves, writing about the Braves, going to every game, basically. Well, not every game, but it's just as many as I did before, if not more. But it's different in that what I'm writing, because just the fundamental difference in the product and the demands of the job, because we're not an advertiser-based outfit, which we were at the AJC, obviously. So everything we did at the AJC, or most everything, was had the intention of getting of selling advertising. So as a result, what you do is end up all the little stuff like videos and that you sell to advertisers and doing multiple stories on a topic that maybe should have been one subject, because it's always better to have, you know, at a newspaper at that's so dependent on advertising, it's always better to have two or three stories than it is one, because you get more clicks. So, you know, it's just a fundamental difference in what you do. We're a subscriber-based publication, so we have no need to get clicks. So when people say clickbait or whatever, you know, they can't really make that charge anymore, because they serve absolutely no purpose for them anymore, clickbait, you know?
Right.
We're not writing stories with sensational headlines or whatever to get more clicks, because we're not trying to sell the subscribers. We're not trying to sell the advertisers. We're just trying to get subscribers. And the way you do that is by writing content, by writing stories that they want to read, you know, in-depth pieces. You get a chance to talk to a lot more people. You're not on deadline pressure like you are at a newspaper, where you're always trying to crank it out, move on to the next story, get that up, post it as soon as possible. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If a trade happens in the afternoon, I can tweet it, but then I can get to work on doing the story and do an in-depth story and file it hours later if I want to, if it works better. You know, I have a chance to talk to people and do a story that puts it into context and perspective, you know, and get those last couple of people I wanted to talk to about it, you know, and just write a better story with a lot more details and more research and all that than I would have if, you know, a trade happened today when I need to get the story up as soon as possible. And then I update it, you know, but you end up, you know, moving on doing something else or writing something else about the trade in a separate story and what it means or who they might go out and pursue. Same thing now with a game story. I don't publish a game story at the last pitch like I had to because deadlines, they wanted to try to get it in as many of their electronic edition as they could. And our deadlines have become so early at my newspaper that, you know, we don't want to get any night games into the print product. So, but you were still having to publish a story at the last pitch just so you can get it up for the digital subscribers. And, you know, you end up racing, trying to get to the elevator to the clubhouse after the game. So you have to get a story done. And if the game changes the ninth inning, you're doing a massive rewrite. And, you know, it lends itself to making mistakes or not being able to put things in any kind of context. You just jam it in and get it up. And then you can update from there and write, you know, more after you get back from the clubhouse. But you're just always kind of chasing your tail and always under intense deadline. And I just don't think you end up producing nearly as good a work that you can feel good about and proud about and inform people with as you can when you have a chance to kind of sit back and put things into perspective and write instead of just rushing and instead of just getting it up as soon as possible and moving on.
Right.
So that part really changed. We're basically writing one story a day now on the days I write, which is most days, but not every day. But writing one story a day and trying to tell stories, you know, trying to incorporate things and draw readers in and entertain and inform rather than just jamming a bunch of facts in. You know, it's really satisfying as a writer. It's you don't get this many opportunities in the business in this day and age to do what we're doing now. And you're seeing a lot of guys really kind of shine that maybe weren't getting opportunities to do so in recent years. A lot of people feel like and I'm one of them, that you kind of get a chance to spread your wings again, or you get a chance to kind of grow again, which maybe had given up on advancing as far as, you know, taking what you do to another level. And you didn't really see that opportunity as long as we were, you know, in the rat race at newspapers. But a whole lot of guys have moved over from newspapers to The Athletic and are really producing some of the best work they've done in their careers, in my opinion.
Yeah. Well, congratulations again. I am enjoying it already.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. All right.
All right, man. So let's start at the end of the season. I'm fascinated by the fact that Markakis, who was always so quiet, spoke to the team after the Game 4 loss. Any reactions from players or comments that maybe didn't make it into your article that you could share?
He had people on the edge of tears and some outright crying. Everybody in the room was kind of misty-eyed. And you know, while he doesn't say a lot, he says enough on a daily basis. And he has interactions with players every day. I mean, certain guys, especially, surprisingly, well, maybe to those outside, but surprisingly, he has great relationships with some of the younger players, like Ozzie Albies, for instance. You know, you would never picture that maybe, but those two are really close. And you can always see him over chatting with Ozzie and cutting up with Ozzie. So he has great relationships with his teammates. It's just that he doesn't, he's not real vocal, and he doesn't sit at his locker waiting for us to talk to him. You know, he's available if we want him when asked. And when he comes in there, if you're in there when he comes in the locker room, he never turns down interviews or declines interviews. It's just that he doesn't go out of his way to talk about himself or to be interviewed. But so when he speaks, he doesn't say a whole lot, and he's not a real vocal person. He's not, you know, talking a lot in the dugout during games. So when he speaks, people listen to him. It's not just they know it's important. If he deigns to talk, then they know it's something that they should listen to usually, and he usually has something to say rather than just idle chit chat. But when he talked after that game, all the guys knew there's a chance, you know, a pretty good chance that was his last game as a Brave, and he expressed to them how great a season he had had, how great a time he had had playing with these guys, not just this season, but some of them for multiple years. But and they said it was really heartfelt, and they could tell he meant every word of it. So this was a special team in the clubhouse. You know, you don't do what they did, improve by as much as they did, without something going right, and in the clubhouse, and guys really getting along and wanting to play hard and play and stay together and go through the adversity they did and not allow it to consume this season or turn the season around and cut short what was, you know, their aspirations, which they didn't. Every time they had a struggle that, you know, got swept by the Rockies or the Dodgers, then they bounced back and came back strong. And there was something to that. The character in the clubhouse helped him a lot in that regard, and he was at the center of all of that. I mean, by example, was kind of the alpha dog of the team. Not as a guy that, you know, got it gung ho, yelling "Let's go" and all that. He didn't have to. He did it by example and his intensity and his daily approach to the game and how hard he worked. And guys saw him in the locker room or in the weight room. In the training room, what he went through every day to play. And they took their cues from that. So it couldn't be a better example as far as the team is concerned with having a veteran to kind of set an example for the younger players coming up and not really sure what it takes to get through a season and be a championship-type player. he was the perfect guy for them to point to and go, just do what he's doing. So, but so when he spoke, people listened, and he said he was a lot more open maybe than he is normally in those settings and team settings, group settings. So that really kind of, you know, made it even more kind of emotional and heartfelt. They could tell that he wanted, because he didn't have to speak, and they knew that. He could have easily just, you know, well, that's it. Hey, see you guys later. It's a great deal, but great playing with you, but that's it probably for me. But he could have done that, but he instead stood up and poured his heart out, and they hadn't really seen him do that in that setting. So it made it all the more powerful, what he had to say. Yeah. Which, and from what I understand, what he had to say was very inspirational and poignant as well. So they felt really good about that and how much they had meant to his life. You know, these young guys that have just starting out their careers, to have this veteran talk about how much he had meant to them, it really meant something that touched them.
Yeah, so you kind of teed up the next thing I wanted to ask. It's that resiliency, that ability that the team never let things truly go off the rails, which as a fan I kind of expected at a few different points during the season. You mentioned that Rocky sweep, of course, the Giants sweep. I mean, there was a number of them.
Absolutely.
Was that the most surprising thing to you?
The Red Sox series with that disastrous, tremendous collapse.
Absolutely.
Was it what? I'm sorry?
Well, I was just going to ask, like, that was the most surprising thing for me and probably equally the most satisfying thing for me. What surprised you most covering the team this year?
It was probably that, the resilience, which was a really unusual, highly unusual levels of resiliency for any team, much less a team with so many key components, so many key plus members who were either rookies or guys in their first full season. That's the kind of thing you might see from a scrappy bunch of veterans who've been bounced around or kicked around. Maybe like that Red Sox team that won at that time, the first time when they came back when they were down 3-0 against the Yankees, you know, with Kevin Millar and all these old crusty veterans type players. That's something you might expect from a team like that. Not from a bunch of guys who have never really been through it before, so had no really way of knowing how to do it. So, again, a lot of that has to come back to, a lot of that has to come back to not just the veterans like Nick and Kurt Suzuki and Tyler Flowers and Freddie Freeman and Ender Inciarte, even it's hard saying a veteran, he hasn't been around that long, but a lot of it comes back to those guys, but also to the coaching staff and, of course, Brian Snitker. I mean, the tone is set at the top, whether it's obvious in the ways it's done, you know, with speeches every day and hard ass guys talking to guys every day and drilling them, or whether it's done just in an amalgamation or a combination of how guys go about coaching them and the relationships they build with the guys, their position guys. And then the guy at the top allowing the coaches to deferring to the coaches and delegating duties to them and allowing them to build these relationships. And all that happens. I would argue it's as good a coaching staff as it is in the major leagues. I think they probably have, other than Snitker, I think they probably have more major league playing experience maybe than any current staff. But it's not just that playing experience. It's that how they carry themselves. They're all good guys. All the coaches are that the players genuinely like and they want to be around. So when your group of position players or pitchers, if you're the pitching coach or the bullpen coach or whatever, if they want to be around you and work for you, that goes a long way. And guys like Ron Washington and Kevin Seitzer and Eric Young, Senior and Walt Weiss, who had a great reputation as a player's manager, but a disciplinarian, a hard ass, but yet a player's manager with the Rockies. I mean, a guy didn't take any guff, but had an open door policy. Players always knew they could come in and talk to him, that kind of thing. So he was the perfect guy to add as a bench coach, in my opinion. So, and also Jose Castro, who never gets mentioned, is the assistant hitting coach and is kind of a liaison with some of the Latin players, you know, and he really helps Seitzer a lot. So the combination of those two with the hitters is a really good one. And but you know, the work that Wash does with his infielders, it's something to see every day. But this all played into a team that is on the same page and has this vibe running through it that they're not going to let a game or a series get them down. They want to reach their potential. They all like each other, want to play hard for each other, and they like their coaches and the coaching staff, and they don't resent, and the coaches don't resent each other or have any kind of backstabbing going on. And, you know, which those kind of things can be poison in a clubhouse when there's one, you know, coach that's really not on the same page and you feel like he's there to try to advance his career. And those kind of things in a baseball season, much more than any other sport, when they're around each other as much as they are and they're playing games every night and they're losing a lot of them and going through adversity, you see sides of people that maybe you don't see when you play once a week. And it's all about testosterone pumping and 3 to 4 hours of the football game. When you're playing every night and you're watching a guy and you see his reaction in the dugout and you see him there for 4 hours in a game and, you know, in the hours leading up to a game, you know, and after a game, and it's 162 times. A guy's personality is there laid bare. I mean, there's no hiding it. He's a good guy or he's not a good guy, or he's, you know, a guy that's in it for the right reasons or he's not, or he's in it to advance his career and has one foot out the door or he doesn't. You know, those kind of things show up. And this team put together a coaching staff and a manager that as you've, you know, we don't need to extol his virtues because the players have. But all of that, I think, plays into it. And I think they hit it. You just hope that chemistry continues, you know, and I think they don't make many changes. And I think it will. You know, all the coaches should be back, unless one of them gets a managerial job. But I haven't really heard any movement for that yet. So they got that going for them. And that's a huge, huge plus right out from the get-go, where you ask, can they repeat next year or, you know, continue to advance next year? That's a huge plus in their favor, in my opinion, is that you're not having any kind of wholesale changes in the coaching staff or in the leadership of the team. Although, you know, if they lose Suzuki and Markakis both, that'll be a void that needs to be filled by other veteran type leaders or guys, you know, emerging as veterans as they have more experience. We'll see where that goes.
Right. So there is, of course, one change in the coaching staff, and that's Chuck Hernandez. And there's,
yeah,
I mean, basically what I've read is go in a different direction, some sort of references to not incorporating analytics, maybe like they wanted. Any more detail you can provide on his departure?
Not really. I don't think, because none was really pointed to and on or off the record. Alex Antonopoulos, the GM, is really good about maybe a little different than previous regimes at not kind of pointing out a guy's flaws once he has no use for him anymore. In other words, kicking him while he's on the way out, or, you know, feeling the need to defend his decision, that kind of thing. So you don't get, and this is to his credit, you know, as much as I would like to know and other reporters would like to know if there was any specific incidents or reason why they think there were so many walks, for instance, you won't get that from Alex. He will not off the record, and neither will his lieutenants, say that this guy sucked at this part of the coaching regime and the program, and that he wasn't able to do this or grasp this, or he had conflicts with this guy and this guy. He won't do that, and I think that's a good thing. But it is kind of frustrating that you can't really pinpoint exactly one thing, if there was one or two things why he was fired. But ultimately the results, you know, told you that maybe there needed to be a change, because there was just an inordinate amount of walks. And the way the bullpen kind of collapsed in mass down the stretch, and also, you know, a couple of starters, you know, Newcomb's first and second halves were just so, there was such a disparity. You wondered why he couldn't really get it back, what he was doing the first half. Yeah. Fatigue couldn't really be blamed on that because it started much earlier than, you know, it started, you know, it was around 100 innings or whatever, earlier than that even. So just a long story short, no, I don't know if there was one thing. I think it was what you mentioned. The analytics, this team is an analytics-based unit now in a lot of ways. They really rely on that stuff a lot. So it helps a lot when everybody is up to speed on the analytics and is open about using them and you know, not just willing, but excited about using a lot of it. They don't have to all use all of it, but the parts that they do use, you know, it helps a lot when they're used with enthusiasm and the players believe that this is good and this is why we're doing it. So, you know, I think that probably played into it, you know, but you just, there aren't many coaching staffs that stay together just fully intact, you know, year after year after year. And for them to make only one change after, you know, falling short in a division series and the pitching staff putting up some kind of odd numbers, you know, in that they were among the league leaders in this, in that category, and then so low in a couple other categories. So, you know, that's one of those things where the GM talks to the players throughout the year or during or even down the stretch when he's making a decision on going forward and gets their opinions on it and gets other coaches' opinions on it and makes a decision based on that. So he probably just felt like a change. He maybe even wants to get one of his own guys in there, you know, because he hasn't made a lot of changes in that regard. But when he brought in Walt Weiss and EY Senior, a year ago, you know, that was frankly the decisions that I was like, you're getting rid of Terry Pendleton and Eddie Perez. And I didn't want to see those guys go because they're such good guys. And Eddie, I've seen TP, you know, work so hard over the years to get where he was. And I hated seeing those guys go. But in the end, those were good moves. I mean, those two guys were instrumental in the coaching staff, EY and Walt Weiss in this season. So, as much as I did not want to see either of them go, it was good getting those guys in because they were both great fits. So I'm not going to really question his decision to replace the coaching staff, the pitching coach.
Sure.
At least until I see who it brings in.
So staying with the starting pitching, David, obviously there's a ton. But as I see it, as they head into the offseason, there's sort of tiers. You've got, my assumption, Folty and Gausman are locks. Newcomb and Soroka are kind of question marks, whether it's because of, you know, second half performance or because of health. You've got all the young guys who are kind of not proven. Tukey, Fried, Wilson, Wright, Gohara, Tehran and Sanchez are kind of in their own. Maybe they're not re-signed. Maybe they get traded.
Yeah, there's so many.
Yeah, there's so many. I mean, if you had to pencil in, who are you confident we're going to see in the five-man rotation next year of that?
Oh, man. Yeah, it's tough. Folty. I'll put Folty.
Yeah.
For sure.
Because Gausman could get traded even, right?
Yeah, he could. But I think it's more likely that he was a good fit, really liked being here. And although his performance tapered off in September, obviously, he was really impressive for that first month after he made some adjustments. And we saw what he can do. And the arm's never been in question. You know, he's got great stuff. He goes hard. And I think they'd probably, you know, having salary control of him, I would expect him to be back. Because I think he's probably more valuable to the Braves than he would be to other teams, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
I don't know that teams are going to give up a lot for Gausman. Usually teams, if Braves make trades, it's going to be for big-time guys. And those teams that are trading them are rebuilding teams or teams moving. They're not looking for a Gausman. They're, you know, generally speaking, they're looking for prospects. So I would expect him to be back. Newcomb, I think he'll be back. I mean, the first half, he pitched like an all-star for 2 months. You know, there was a time, we forget, but there was a time in May where he and Folty were, it was like flip a coin on which one deserved to be more of an all-star.
Yep.
They were literally, you know, in the top five in the league in most stats. But he really fell off in the second half. And the walks continue to be such an issue with him. But the great stuff, big, strong left-hander, great stuff. But I could see him being included in a trade. He's not a guy that feel like I don't think there's a fear now that if you trade him, he could go somewhere else and become an ace, a frontline 1-2 type guy that you would regret trading. So I think that a lot more so now than you would have a year ago, you could see him dealt. Gohara was a total disaster this year. I mean, he's the guy that he was the guy that they get the irony being he was the guy, the rookie that you penciled in as the one of all of them. He was the guy you said he'll be in the rotation of five, and then the others are going to be battling for spots. But he was the guy coming in spring training that everybody had penciled in. And he put on so much weight during his difficult offseason. That has been well chronicled. And then, you know, the injuries just started. A lot of it probably had to do with the added weight, you know, the ankle sprain and all that. And he was just never a factor. So, and I don't know if he's going to be a factor going forward. He could be dealt too, although his trade value obviously is at a low now that it's ever been since the Braves got him from Seattle trade. But going back to your original question, I would pencil in Folty. I think Gausman will be there for the reasons we just said. I can't see Tuki Toussaint not in there. I mean, he was so impressive to me. I think he has one of those spots. I really do.
I would hope so. I think Tuki and Soroka, like you said, you know, there's less of a concern.
Yeah.
Newcomb goes and becomes an ace somewhere, but Tuki and Soroka are in that category.
Yes.
For me.
Exactly. Yeah. Our top half the rotation type guys.
Yep.
You can see that. Freed a little less so, but mm-hmm. Freed also is really good. He's a smart guy with a terrific curveball, and when he's on, you saw what he did against the Cardinals when he brought him up and that for that start against the Cardinals, and he got that huge road trip really going. That sweep of the Cardinals, he had that incredible game against them, but then he's just as likely the next time out get shelled. So he's that's a young pitcher, you know. I think he's a lot more. If you look back at the rookie seasons for guys like, you know, Smoltz, Glavine, and Maddux, and you see the numbers, the some really great starts and some really bad starts. To me, Max Fried is a guy like that, in that I'm not saying he's going to be a future Hall of Famer, but I'm saying he's got the stuff to be a really good pitcher. And as long as he gets his health, he stays healthy and keeps getting stronger, a little bigger, he could still be, to me, a top half of the rotation guy. So behind Toussaint and Soroka, I don't think there's any others, you know, except for the younger guys coming up, which you don't know about yet. But there's some of those guys that are really good. But Freed's really good. I don't know that I'd give him up yet. But in a trade, I could certainly see him having a lot of value and the Braves being less reluctant to deal him than they would be Toussaint or Soroka, so if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So I think of the guys we discussed, I think the most likely to be here, Folty, Gausman, Toussaint, Soroka, the shoulder he pitched during instructional league, faced batters a couple times with no difficulty. So, you know, anytime it's a shoulder, you kind of cross your fingers and hope. You know, the Braves have a lot more evidence and medical reports on him, and they look at closely with a fine-tooth comb, you know, there's MRIs of his shoulder to make sure there's nothing structurally wrong. And he wouldn't have pitched again this year, even in instructional league, if there was anything wrong other than an inflammation. And as many CT scans and MRIs as they did on him, that would show up in all the tests they did on him. That would show up if there was an extensive injury there, and they wouldn't have let him go back out. So I think it was probably just, you know, a mechanical thing. He's got a little bit different mechanics, and I think he's probably putting a lot of stress on it once he ramped it up at this level. You know, the intensity gets ramped up, and things that maybe the guys got away with at the lower levels all of a sudden become an issue, and it can lead to inflammation like he had and soreness that he never dealt with, and this scared him. So, but in the end, that's usually all it is soreness, and guys realize, hey, this is what it's like up here. You never really feel 100% like you did before because the intensity of this competition and what you're doing each night going out and pitching, these things kind of come to the fore. But, yeah, I could see him being in there with Tuki and Folty and Gausman. And then, man, you got a handful of guys that are competing for that for the last spot. If that were the case, and those aren't traded, but and none of the guys we mentioned are traded. But Teron, the only reason if he's not traded this winter, the only reason would be that that club-friendly contract that was so amazingly club-friendly, you know, a year or two ago, no longer looks quite as club-friendly anymore. It looks more like, well, that's probably about what he should be getting paid when you look at, you know, what his salary is now and what he's done the last couple of years. You know, he's reached the crossroads in his career, kind of. He is what he is, and I don't think he's going to revert to being a frontline caliber opening day type starter again, even though he's still really young. There's really not much reason to believe that he's just going to flip a switch and become that guy again. And he's more of a back end of the rotation guy now for a good team probably than he is a frontline guy that for an up and coming team. So I could see him getting traded if the Braves can get not if they can get anything for him, because they're not really going to get anything for him, I don't think. But if they can get a team to pick up his salary. And you never really thought you'd be at that point with Julio Teheran, you know, while he's still in this contract. But I think you are. And if you could get somebody to take his whole salary, you know, and give you as part of a deal, maybe I could see trading him this offseason. To me, he's not a bullpen guy. So I don't think that's really an option, even though he pitched well in that one relief stint in the division series when he did come in. And it was a blowout game at that point. I think he had something to prove. So. But I don't think that that's his role, especially given his first inning woes.
Yeah, no, I agree. I'll be shocked if I see him on the team next year. But
and there were some others. You probably got them listed in front of you if you want to run them by me. But I forgot the others that you mentioned.
Yeah, I mentioned Wilson, who had that great start in Pittsburgh.
Oh, yeah, he's impressive, man. Bryce Wilson is impressive. Throws home a real strong guy that you don't really have any doubts about him being able to handle a full season and all that kind of thing. They're really high on him. And yeah, he had that unbelievable debut. He had a couple of good starts, but then he also got shelled in a couple. So, you know, he's still a young guy that has a lot of things to work on, but yeah, we could see him again for sure. But another guy that other teams will be interested in now that they've seen him, now that there's some film of him pitching at the big league level, people realize how hard he throws. He's another guy that teams will be asking about this year. And the Braves have such a stockpile of an inventory of pitching prospects that they could afford to lose a guy like him.
Do you think the Braves?
Kyle.
Yeah.
Kyle was another.
Right. Kyle. Right. What do you think the front office thinks about Colby Allard after what we saw of him this year? Because it wasn't
Colby
very
Allard
impressive.
Could be traded for sure. Yeah. And Kyle Wright, a lot less so. They love Kyle Wright still, even though I know the results weren't there, you know, in the majority of his outings. He was really pitching out of it. That's not really his role. You know, he's a starter, and they were trying to find some innings for him, get his feet wet. So people shouldn't make too big of an evaluation of Kyle Wright based on his work this year. I think the team, he's still a guy that was pitching at Vandy, what, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago at the most. But he's still a guy they're really high on, and there's no reason to believe he can't be a top half of the rotation type guy. So he's another that could compete for the rotation next year, you know?
Yeah.
And then I think they could go out. But Allard, to answer your question, I think Allard, his limitations were exposed. In that he's just not a guy that throws real hard. He's an undersized guy who's a really kind of a he got at the minor league level. He threw hard enough that with his breaking stuff and his kind of craftiness and his grit, he's a really good competitor. All those things made him a really good minor league pitcher. The big league level, it's a little different. Man, the limitations are exposed. So unless you've got a trick pitch, if you're nowadays in this game where it's gone now, throwing 90 is like throwing 85, you know, just 5 or 6 years ago. So I could see him getting traded for sure. It's going to be tough for him to get a rotation spot for sure next year. I just don't see it with the guys that are coming back. And we haven't even mentioned the fact that they could definitely go out and get a guy, you know. We're probably going to get to that part of this conversation, but they could go out and get a guy because as many good young arms as they have, and it probably would have seen, you know, some fans probably get frustrated by the fact that they spent so much time acquiring pitching prospects and so much capital during the rebuild, they kept drafting and trading for pitching prospects, and people kept saying, where are the bats? Bring in the bats. But they didn't get bats because Scotty said, you know, they couldn't find bats like they could arms, and you could use these arms as capital to get bats. Well, now you might have to use some of these arms to get an arm, because as many great young pitching prospects as they have, and they have a bunch, there's still a lot of them that just aren't quite ready yet or are knocking at the door. Some of the really best ones. We haven't even mentioned those guys. But now that you're a year ahead of schedule in most people's views in this rebuild, now that you've got to 90 wins a year sooner than most people, including myself, thought you would, you don't want to spin your wheels and stay at 90. You don't want to, because next year the division should be, at least the top half of the division should be better next year. So you're going to need to get better, I think, to win the division again and get back to the postseason. You don't want to rely on the wild card, especially with as many good teams as there are out west, and in the Central. But so to win 90 again, it's going to be more difficult if you know the Mets are a little better, or if the Nats are a little better, which they certainly could be, and the Phillies should be better. You know, the Phillies made a lot of progress this year before their collapse. They should be better next year. They shouldn't be as easy to beat up on as the Braves found them to be this year. You're going to have to go out, I think, or you don't have to, but it certainly would help to get a bona fide frontline top half the guy, if not an ace, then at least someone, you know, close to Fulte's caliber.
A Patrick Corbin type.
Right, right. You're going to have to go out and get a guy like that, I think. And I've written there, or I tweeted this, that I think while you have this level of this inventory of prospects that you might not ever have again. I mean, there probably aren't any teams in baseball right now with as many top 100 prospects as the Braves had in all the lists. And that's after guys like Acuna have already arrived, you know, they still got all these prospects. I think while you have it all, spend it, some of it, not all of it, don't blow it, but you can afford now to trade some of these guys and go get a genuine big impact, make a big impact trade, and you're not going to be able to protect them all in the Rule 5 in a year or two anyway. So, you know, and some of them are going to get hurt. The longer they stay, some of them are going to get hurt. So, well, I think this is a great time to strike while the iron is hot. I think I just made a combined a couple of metaphors or whatever, but I think you go out and get a frontline guy, and I've mentioned that you make a run at DeGrom. I think you make a genuine run at DeGrom. And I've been one of those that have said the Mets would never trade him within the division. But the only reason I say that you have to make a run at him is I think maybe the Mets, if they decide that it's time to rebuild, because they should decide that, you know, they need to do a rebuild for a couple of years to get back to where they want to be rather than just continuing to try to piece it together and, you know, and do a partial rebuild. They need to go do what the Braves did or close. And if that's going to be the case, then you're not going to be competitive for DeGrom's final 2 years. He's never going to have more trade value than he has right now. 2 years left of arbitration, the best season anybody had in the majors last year. I mean, he was the best pitcher in the major leagues last year, this past season. So, man, can you imagine adding him to the rotation, how that changes everything? I mean, that changes everything.
Oh, yeah.
You know? When you can run him out there and Fulte is your number two, man, you go into – and then, not to mention, you go into a playoff series. Look at what happened this year when they went to face the Dodgers, a team with more depth. You could look at the Dodgers bench and see guys like Matt Kemp, who would have been hitting cleanup for the Braves every day. He didn't hardly even play in the division series for the Dodgers.
Right.
And then you looked at their starting rotation that they ran out there, and they had Ryu and Kershaw at 1-2. Where the Braves had Fulte and Anibal Sanchez, who I love. Anibal had an incredible year. It was so valuable to the Braves. But to have to resort to pitching a guy that you signed to a minor league deal in the last 2 weeks of spring training, a 34-year-old guy that looked to be at the end of his career, he's your number two starter against the Dodgers in the division series. That just tells you where they were starting pitching-wise. Despite all the young guys they have, that – when it came right down to it, at the end of a long season, and most of those guys were worn out or still unproven, the guy you felt best about throwing against the Dodgers was Anibal Sanchez. Well, I think next year, Man, if you could add, and Corbin would also be a huge addition. I mean, that would be right up there too. Then you got two bona fide top of the rotation guys. But if you put DeGrom in there, it changes so much. You go into that postseason series against the Dodgers, and you have DeGrom going in game one and Folty going in game two, maybe everything's different. You know? I mean, because basically against DeGrom, if he pitches like he did this year or close, he's not going to give up more than one or two runs in any game. That's just what he does. And most games, he's going to give up none. None or one run. So, absolutely dominant pitcher, and he's got 2 years left of arbitration, and the price would be huge. But your team now is at a point, you're not rebuilding anymore. You're at a point where you're going to try to win the World Series next year. You know, at a bare minimum, you're going to try to get there and win the pennant. You know, after winning the division this year, you're going to try to want to win more than 90 games and win the pennant. That's what you have to go into the spring training as your goal to me. Well, for a team with that as your goal, you can't really do it not feeling confident about your starting rotation after like one or two guys, right? To me, you have to go out and get a frontline guy. And there aren't many of them frontline guys available. And, right. And maybe DeGrom's not available. But I think if the Mets decide that they're rebuilding, then you can't just assume they wouldn't trade in the division. Because to get back to my original point, if they are rebuilding, if they decide they are going to rebuild, then it doesn't matter if you trade him within the division, you know, who cares? Because if you're not going to be competitive for these next 2 years while his last 2 years of arbitration, then if you can rake the Braves for three or four really good prospects, then what they gave up is going to haunt them potentially a lot more so than DeGrom is going to haunt the Mets. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
From the Mets perspective, if they could get three top prospects from the Braves, then you're almost really maybe more reluctant from the Braves perspective to do it because you don't want to face those guys for the next, you know, 6 years.
Right.
So
yeah,
a lot to consider, but I think you make a run at him or Syndergaard, you know, if they're going to rebuild and they make those guys available, you've got to make a run at DeGrom, the best guy out there. But then if not, then yeah, Corbin, a free agent. There's just not many available, and if we've seen in recent years, the starting pitchers are going to get overpaid. Not as much as they used to maybe a few years ago. They're not going to be any more, you know, 10-year or 8-year deals like Greinke got, but they're going to get overpaid.
Yeah.
And Corbin is probably going to get overpaid. So if it's not just ridiculous overpaid, then yeah, you can do it that way. But if you can use some of your prospect capital and get a guy at a manageable salary for the next 2 years, and then if he likes it as much as you think he will like it here, I mean, he's a guy from Northern Florida, a country guy, all that, you know, from Chipper's neighborhood in Florida. If he likes it as much as you think he likes, then at least you'd have a chance of a good chance of re-signing him, in a couple years. But I don't think you make the deal with that as a prerequisite. I think you make it with knowing he could be the difference maker and get you to the World Series in the next 2 years.
Yeah, and I have to believe Anthopoulos sees that it would be a mistake to go in to next season with a starting rotation of the guy, you know, made up of all the guys we listed, you know, who are in the system right now. I mean, he's got to see that they need to get over the hump in that way. So on that same tack, you know, moving to the position players, right? So in Anthopoulos's press conference last Monday, he indicated he didn't believe there would be value in the big names in the free agent market. So I never even got to wear my Bryce Harper shirt, which is a shame. So, I don't believe, despite what they're saying, I don't believe the Braves are really going to re-sign Nick Markakis. There needs to be more offense, and Real Muto may not happen. Do you agree with that? Do you see Markakis back here next year?
Only if you mentioned Real Muto. Well, if they could trade for Real Muto, then all of a sudden, yeah, I could see Nick Markakis back because you've added a big bat. And the intangibles that Markakis brings and the relatively small salary, probably. I mean, because I think he wants to be back. And he's going to get some offers, but I don't think they're going to be huge offers. And Markakis is not the kind of guy that wants to pick up his family and move again. He's got his place in Baltimore as a year-round home. But his mom and dad came to all the games here, and he loves that aspect of it. His dad, you know, they're from Woodstock, and he loves seeing his retired mom and dad being able to come to the games and all that. So he would come here for just a competitive offer, I'm sure he'd stay. So if you could get and I agree with you, there has to be more offense. And if you could get Realmuto, that's a lot more offense. Yeah. I mean, he's the best all-around catcher in baseball. So if you could add him, you know, then with the expected improvement, you know, if Ozzie can put it together over a full year, not like he played in the first half, but just if he can balance those out a little bit, then he should be a better offensive player next year. He was a disaster in the second half, yeah, relative to the first half. I shouldn't say a disaster because that's kind of demeaning what he did. But the first half numbers compared to the second are just ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, third base, you got a lot of good production from Camargo. And once he moved into that role in late May, once they finally gave up on the two, once they Flaherty, you know, moved to the utility spot and they got rid of Jose Bautista and gave it to Camargo, he played well there. So, Dansby, I think, you know, if healthy, because assuming he'll be healthy, his offensive production should be up. Freddie just had a Freddie season, not great by any stretch of the imagination for Freddie. He should hit for more power, I would think, next year. Ender had such a horrible first half that, you know, so there are reasons to think that this offensive team, while you had guys like Nick Markakis had a career year or close to it, and there could be, you know, you already had the drop off in your catching production from 2017 to this year. So there's no reason to think that there was a fluky year for the Braves. And not to mention, you're going to have Acuna from day one instead of from late April and having missed a whole month after that. So if you could add Realmuto, then all of a sudden this offense is starting to look a lot better to me. And then Austin Riley could be ready at third base he could be ready early in the season. They're not going to rush him, but he could be ready early if he wanted to move, you know, to Camargo to a utility role, or, you know, if somebody else got hurt and you needed to move him over there, Camargo could do that. But you could have Austin Riley's. What I'm saying is he could be ready by midseason, and that's a power bat that you're going to add to the lineup. And you're not expecting, you know, major league power right away from a rookie, obviously, but we've seen plenty of guys do it with other teams in this postseason and late in the year. You saw a lot of guys come up and have impact performances with some of these playoff teams. So maybe he is a guy like that. But going back to what Alex said, you know, when he downplayed, you know, the free agent market with, like, Machado, I just don't think is a good fit here, and I think he's going to get overpaid. I've written that I would Bryce Harper, to me, would be a great sign for the Braves, obviously. It'd be a great sign for everybody, but for the Braves, the way he would fit, some people said, oh, he doesn't fit. You don't need to overpay him. He doesn't fit here. You know, first of all, the clubhouse thing, forget that. You know, the cancer, clubhouse cancer, toxic, forget that. It's not true. He's a product of who he was surrounded with in Washington and all that. Didn't seem like he was real happy to be there at times because the team was frustrating, you know. I'm sure that had something to do with it too.
Yeah.
But he is really good friends. He's become friends with Freddie Freeman over the years. And Freddie would, you know, tells him he should come here. And those guys would love to have him here. And he's not going to come into this clubhouse and be anything other than thrilled to be here if the Braves were able to get him, obviously. He's going to go where he wants to go. He's a free agent, so he's not going to go somewhere he doesn't want to be. And he's not going to come, if he were to come here, he's not going to be the center of everything like he was in D.C., where he's under such scrutiny during the formative years of his career, where he's just coming into his own, expected to do. He's going to come here, and it's still going to be Freddie and Acuna's team.
Yeah.
You know,
oh, yeah.
even with Bryce Harper, who'll be the highest paid guy on the team right away if they were to get him, and arguably, you know, still one of the marquee two or three guys in the National League, it still would be Acuna, the guy that most people is going to have the most jerseys sold. You know,
yeah,
and it's still going to be Freddie's team until proven otherwise. So I think he could come in here and be one of the three guys instead of being the guy that everything was centered around. And I can't even imagine think about having Harper hit three and Freddie hit four. and Acuna hit wherever you want to hit Acuna, you know? If you don't have a leadoff guy emerge and you still have Acuna in leadoff spot with those two guys hitting third and fourth, then hey, so be it. I mean, that would be whoever hits in the first four with them, that could be the best four in the National League, you know? Yeah. Maybe the Dodgers maybe would be better. I don't know. But that could be the best four in the National League, the first four.
Do you think
go ahead. Is it realistic? To get back to what you're saying. Is it realistic? I don't know. But I wouldn't totally dismiss it just because of what Alex said, because there's some posturing there. I mean, they're not going to come right out and say, we've got this many millions to spend. We're going to go. McGurk said something during the year that there's not a guy that – if there's a guy we want, there's not a team that can outbid us. You know, those kind of things. They're not saying those right now, now that it's actually come to the time of the year when it's time to put the money on the table. Because now it's about posturing, not making agents think you have all the money in the world to spend and that you could spend whatever it takes to get this guy or that guy, or letting other teams know that you're going to be at front. You don't want to play, especially Alex is like this. He does not want to show his cards. So he's going to kind of downplay everything. He's going to downplay the money they have. He's going to downplay the likelihood of them pursuing big ticket free agents. He's going to downplay what they would be willing to give up prospect wise to get other guys. He's just going to kind of downplay our expectations and all that, and let other teams and the fans, and not have anybody think too much about the Braves and what they're about to do. And then he's going to make a big move and it's going to surprise people. I really believe that. And while he says that about, you know, the big ticket free agents, Machado and Harper, I wouldn't necessarily think that they've ruled it out, because I don't think they have. I think they'll at least, you know, put a toe in the water and see what Bryce Harper, you know, he's represented by Boris. So it's not going to like he's going to take a big discount to go somewhere and play with alongside some guy that he really likes. I mean, he's going to go where he wants to go, but and get a lot of money. But he's so young that, man, I just can't. If you bring him, if you were able to bring him here and team him with Ronald Acuna for the next 6-7 years, and Freddie is going to be here for most of that time, if not all of it, because I know he wants to stay with the Braves his whole career. You just all of a sudden you have arguably one of the most potent offenses in the National League right away, and arguably the best as Acuna continues to develop, because you would have bona fide two superstars. But I don't know how realistic it is. I know you're going to have to pay Acuna a ton of money to keep him, because I know you're going to want to keep him forever.
Yeah.
So in a couple of years, when you maybe a year or two, when you sign him to a long-term extension and buy out a lot of free agency, you're going to have to give them a massive contract. So you got to have to be confident with your payroll going forward that you can carry, you know, two or three really big salaries. But as the battery starts to kick into gear and all the real estate deals start to pay off, because so far they haven't, because they're still filling, still filling storefronts there, and only started getting rent from people like the Omni Hotel this past year, you know, and a couple other big places, that the Social Place, all those were spots that weren't generating any revenue until this past year. So it's really really complicated, and people don't understand why the revenues haven't jumped enormously right off the bat. But a lot of it has to do with, and I believe the Braves in this regard, because it does make sense when they laid it all out for us in a meeting that they had with some of us when I was with the AJC. They have so much debt hanging over them, or they did, you know, because of how much they financed, they paid to finance the battery, that until you start, everything starts humming there and you start getting all the revenues from those places, which you are now for most of them, like the Omni Hotel. It didn't open until a year ago, until this past year. So until you start getting all those revenues pouring in to offset the initial debt you had, then the profits start coming in after that. And that's when the payroll should really jump a lot. And then eventually your TV deal is going to come up too in the next decade. Your TV deal is going to come up. And at that point, whatever the prevailing prices are at that time, the Braves should be at the forefront as far as being able to strike a huge regional TV deal if those things still exist at that point because of their fan base is so big, so widespread. So there are reasons to believe, long story short, that revenues are going to increase a lot and allow you to carry a big payroll in the future. Not this year. It's not going to be enormous, but I think it'll move up a little bit this year. And then I think it'll be steady. I think it'll steadily rise until you are back in the top 10, you know, in the not too distant future.
All right, David, that is a great note to end it on, man. Thank you very much for your time. Looking forward to this offseason. Should be one of the most exciting ones we've had in a long time. So, folks, if you're not signed up for The Athletic, do it. I did it when DOB moved over, and I have not regretted it. David, thanks again, man. Have a good offseason, and we will talk to you in the spring. All right, time to wrap things up, but first, a quick break. So, folks, the Braves head to the offseason, and so do we. So I want to send big, big thanks to Kurt and Hammy for another season. This was the end of our 11th full season. Most of all, big, big thanks to all of you. Everybody that listens, everybody that interacts with us on Twitter. It is really a gift. We just love it. We love doing it. And, it wouldn't be worth it without everybody who tunes in and, you know, converses with us on Twitter. We really, really appreciate that. And with that, folks, that is the show. We will be back periodically through the off season as big moves happen. And, about once a month. And as stuff happens, we will be back on and we will tweet about it. Make sure folks know. So remember, you can always find us at Blog Talk Radio, as well as iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spreaker. And you can find us at AtlantaBaseballTalk.com to access all of our shows and to post in our comment section. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at ATL Baseball Talk and to like us on Facebook. Thanks again for listening, and go Braves!
Thanks for listening to Atlanta Baseball Talk, your weekly podcast for all things Atlanta Braves. To find new shows, to post in our forum, or to send a comment, please visit us at AtlantaBaseballTalk.com.